Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Over the past half century, there have been a significant number of federal and Supreme Court cases testing the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment. That clause specifically reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion." But what does establishment entail? Does placing a nativity scene on the lawn of City Hall constitute establishment? What about allowing the Boy Scouts, an organization that extols reverence to God, to use public property for their meetings? Is that a government endorsement of religion that is expressly prohibited by the First Amendment? In many of these Establishment Clause debates, the focus of attention revolves around another well-known phrase, a wall of separation. Interestingly, this phrase does not appear anywhere in the U.S. Constitution. Rather, it comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to a group of Baptist ministers in the state of Connecticut in 1802. Nonetheless, given Jefferson's importance in the writing of the U.S. Constitution, the meaning of the phrase wall of separation has become a topic of intense debate in constitutional law cases. Likewise, James Madison's famous Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments, a document pertaining to a specific legislative battle regarding the funding of the Anglican Church in Virginia following the Revolutionary War, is also cited frequently in religious establishment cases. To help provide some context to the wall of separation debate and how the thinking of various other founding fathers have affected our contemporary legal notions of the proper role of church and state, I'm joined today by Mark David Hall, the Herbert Hoover Distinguished Professor of Political Science at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon. Mark is the author of numerous articles on the religious thinking of our founding fathers, has co-edited several books on the topic, including The Sacred Rights of Conscience, Selected Readings on Religious Liberty and Church-State Relations in the American Founding, as well as The Forgotten Founders on Religion and Public Life. He also has a forthcoming monograph entitled The Old Puritan in a New Nation, Roger Sherman and the Creation of the American Republic, due out soon with University of Notre Dame Press. We will link to a number of these sites, and I should also note that Mark is also the president-elect of Christians in Political Science, an organization of scholars who are devoted to their Christian faith. Mark, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Well, later in the podcast, I would like to talk about contemporary church-state separation cases and specifically how the Supreme Court justices have interpreted the Establishment Clause in light of the writings of various founding fathers. But I think we need to begin by putting this debate in its historical context. I guess the logical place to start seems to be this phrase, wall of separation. That has entered into and perhaps even dominated the lexicon of current church-state debates. So tell us a little bit of how this wall of separation phrase came to be.
Sure. Well, as you pointed out already, it was in a letter that Thomas Jefferson, as president, wrote to a group of Baptists in Danbury, Connecticut. By way of broader context, we could go deeper if you'd like. The Baptists in the 17th century, even into the 18th century, were a persecuted minority, and particularly in New England, where the Congregationalists ruled. By the early 19th century, they had they were pretty well accommodated by the Congregationalists and the Federalists who ruled in Connecticut, but they still felt discriminated against. They felt a powerful conviction that people should be completely free with respect to religion.
Now, we're talking here at the year 1800, and Massachusetts, and many people might not know this, but Massachusetts had a state church until 1813 or...
1832, even farther,
so I knew it had three in there. Connecticut in 1800, did they have an established church as well?
Well, what they had at that time was a multiple establishment, so that if you go back 100 years to the early 18th century, the Congregationalist Church was only the only game in town. And in fact, if you go back a little further, groups like Baptists and Quakers were actually prohibited from being in the state. The Parliament's Act of Toleration required the toleration of Baptists and Quakers and whatnot, but they would still be charged to pay for the Congregationalist ministry. Toward the end of the 18th century, though, most states in New England, I guess all states actually, adopted a system of plural or multiple establishments where you were required to support the minister for your church. And if you went to no church at all, you'd still have to support the Congregationalist church. And you could even be exempted from paying taxes to support any church if you wanted. But in order to do this, you had to file a certificate with the state. So in 1802, the Baptists actually weren't charged anything to support the Congregationalist church, but they had to file certificates, whereas Congregationalists didn't. And so they felt this was very, very unfair. So the Baptists were big advocates of religious liberty, and they saw Thomas Jefferson as a big advocate of religious liberty as well. They were some of the few supporters of Thomas Jefferson in the election of 1800, an election in which religion figured very, very prominently.
It was a hotly contested election, and Jefferson felt burned in part by the religious connections to it, didn't he?
That's right, and so did John Adams. Basically, Jefferson said John Adams is going to create a national establishment, mm-hmm. and the Federalist and John Adams said that Jefferson's a deist who's anti-religious. And so religion figured very prominently there. John Adams won handedly in New England, but Jefferson won in the South and the Middle Atlantic states, so was able to become president. And so the proximate cause for the letter to the Danbury Baptist is these Danbury Baptists got together and they wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson congratulating him on winning the presidency. And Jefferson then took it as an opportunity to respond to them and particularly to explain why he, unlike George Washington and John Adams, didn't issue calls for prayer and fasting, a very common practice done by the Continental and Confederation Congress, done by Washington, as I said, Adams. And here's Jefferson, this president who had been accused of being anti-religious, and he refuses to issue these calls. And so, as Daniel Dreisbach and Jim Hudson and others have shown, this is a very political letter. It's meant for public consumption. He's explaining his views on what the First Amendment requires. And so in writing back to these Danbury Baptists, and he's clearly writing for publication, he sends it to fellows on his cabinet for some input. He goes through several drafts. He sends it to newspapers himself. And in this letter, then, Thomas Jefferson explains what he understands the First Amendment to require, which is a wall of separation between church and state.
Now, I want to mention, we are recording this in early May. It's actually May 5th, Wednesday. And this is the day before the National Day of Prayer. And this is in the year 2010. And we were going to come back and wrap around to an issue regarding the constitutionality of the National Day of Prayer. So this national calls for prayer weren't something that was debated 200 years ago and that we would wrap around. The stuff that happened 200, 225 years ago is still very, very relevant today. So we'll get back to that. But go ahead, tell us a little bit about the issue, that statement, wall of separation. What was the context of this? Was he saying that if there's ever an organization called the Boy Scouts of America, they can't meet on public property? What does wall of separation mean for Jefferson?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. In fact, Jefferson wrote the letters to the Danbury Baptist on June 2nd, the very day he received the great Baptist leader John Leland, who himself is a great advocate of the separation of church and state. On January 3rd, the very next day, Leland preached in the U.S. House of Representatives, and Jefferson went and attended this church service, and it was nothing but a church service in the U.S. House of Representatives. And so whatever exactly Thomas Jefferson meant by the separation of church and state, it is a far cry from what the ACLU would have us think it meant. Let me say as well, it's very likely, actually, that Jefferson didn't issue calls for prayer and fasting because he considered the national government to be limited by the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. But as governor of Virginia, he issued calls for prayer and fasting. He wrote a statute in his revision of the laws in Virginia saying when the governor could issue such calls. And informally, in his inaugural address, for instance, he invites Americans to join him in praying to God. So Jefferson, it would be inaccurate. Jefferson was probably a deist. We know this from his private letters. Publicly, right. Though, this seems to be either a First or maybe even a Tenth Amendment requirement. It certainly was a far cry from any sort of complete separation. So the idea that Boy Scouts couldn't meet on public land would have been completely alien to Thomas Jefferson.
Let's take it back a little bit further, because the First Amendment of the Constitution really is a reflection upon Virginia's religious freedom statute that came out. And you have James Madison in his famous Memorial and Remonstrance. I love that name, Memorial and Remonstrance. That remonstrance. It sounds like something I tell my 10-year-old son that if he doesn't eat his vegetables, the remonstrance is coming out. But remonstrance is just a very vigorous argument in case of something. Madison is making this argument in 1785, 1786, shortly after the end of the Revolutionary War, and what to deal with the Anglican Church here. Now, one of the things that I found is interesting, that when that document is cited, it's always cited as memorial and remonstrance, period. But it's memorial and remonstrance against church assessments. So tell us a little bit about that debate, because that might give us insight on what establishment of religion meant in the late 1700s, early 1800s, as compared to today.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. And in fact, you didn't know this, Tony, but I'm writing a law review article right now on the Virginia statute and the Memorial and Remonstrance and its impact upon the writers of the First Amendment. And you're exactly right. Both documents have been cited a lot, the Memorial and Remonstrance over 23 times in different Supreme Court opinions, the Virginia statute over 10 times, and of course Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists has been cited a whole lot of times. By way of context, again, it is important to note, as much as Jefferson has been cited, Jefferson actually had nothing to do, at least nothing immediately to do, with writing the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. He was over in France at the time. And so oftentimes people say, well, it's okay that he wasn't there, because, of course, he did this great work in Virginia.
Right.
One of the things I'm looking at, though, is one thing to assert this, and it's asserted lots of times. I've documented by prominent historians, prominent law professors, they say, and of course jurists, say this is a key influence upon the authors of the Constitution, the Virginia experience. But I'm asking why. What's the evidence of this? Mm. Okay, so I'll give you a little bit of context, and we'll talk about the path of these documents. Virginia had an established church almost since the beginning of the colony.
Right.
And after the War for Independence, and in every state where the Anglican Church, the Church of England, was the established church, as you might imagine, England lost the war, they're the bad guys, and there's a reaction against this. And so in 1776, pretty much right away, financial support was ceased for the Church of England, and Jefferson was actually charged with revising the laws of Virginia.
Well, as I understood it too, a number of the clergy for the Anglican Church up and left, because they were considered royalists, they were obviously targets, and you wouldn't want to be in that kind of situation when war breaks out.
No, that's exactly right. In fact, they were some of the most prominent supporters of the British side. By way of contrast, I've only found one Reformed minister who supported the British. All the Congregationalist ministers, all the Presbyterian ministers supported the Patriot side. And in fact, in England to this day, sometimes the American Revolution is referred to as a Presbyterian rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, to retreat, Jefferson in 1777 penned the statute, the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty. And yet there still were conservatives in Virginia, Patrick Henry being one of their leaders.
They give me liberty or give me death.
Right? Exactly right. But George Washington as well. George Washington said, look, it's perfectly reasonable to require people to support the churches that they attend. And so there's a long story, we could go into it. But the proximate facts that are relevant for us is the conservatives, Patrick Henry, pushed a bill that would require or permit a general assessment, the sort of thing we just talked about in New England,
right,
where the Anglican Church wouldn't be favored, but if you attended a Presbyterian church, you would be required to support the Presbyterian church with tax dollars. If you attended an Anglican church, you'd support that church. If you attended a Moravian church, you'd support that church. And if you attended a church that just didn't want anything to do with the government, the Quakers, the Mennonites, or the Baptists, they were actually exempted from this. And in fact, the Patrick Henry statute would have allowed atheists to have their money sent to public education. Hmm. And so it was a very, very generous statute. But it is true. James Madison, he said, look, we don't even want this sort of involvement. And so Madison cleverly, through some legislative maneuvers and through getting Patrick Henry kicked up into the governorship, so out of the General Assembly, he was able to let the bill die in 1785, and or tabled for a while. And to make sure it stayed dead, he wrote his famous Memorial and Remonstrance, where basically he says the government shouldn't be involved in religion at all. If you read the document, he says, he gives important reasons. He says when the government is involved with religion, it hurts religion. It's
Absolutely,
bad
yeah.
for religion. So to think, you know, whatever his private beliefs, and he was very, very private about his personal beliefs, his public arguments are arguments, what we need to do to help religion is get the government out of the business of religion. Well, he issued this in 1785. It was circulated throughout the state. I actually have some numbers for you on this. There were a number of petitions that were circulated. Madison's wasn't the most influential. In fact, it only received about 1,500 signatures out of 10,000 signatures. And so what we've taken, historians have taken this document that was important, but wasn't the most important document. There was a far more orthodox petition, actually, that received far more signatures than this. It was circulated in print form throughout the state. And eventually led, I think, to the permanent death of Patrick Henry's statute. And instead, the General Assembly passed Jefferson's statute for religious liberty in 1786.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Jefferson, by way of influence, the Moral Remonstrance was published one place outside of Virginia. Otherwise, it was a completely internal document to Virginia. The Virginia statute was published throughout the land. One of the things I've been attempting to look at, though, is, okay, so people might have seen it, but are there references to it? Did people in the era look to Virginia and did they say, we need to have a First Amendment so that we're more like Virginia? The nation should do what Virginia did. And the answer is no. So my question is, why do we favor Virginia?
That's an absolutely fascinating thing. I mean, this is something I just learned right here, is because if you read any history book or any legal documents, the Virginia statute is the favored document that influences that First Amendment. That's the influence of Jefferson and Madison making their way into the Constitution. So yeah, tell me more about this. This is interesting.
Well, that is the argument, but consider this. There were at least three, maybe four states that didn't have an established church.
Right.
And if the First Amendment says we aren't going to have an established church, why don't we say Pennsylvania is a model for the First Amendment, or Rhode Island,
right.
Or Delaware. A number of other states disestablished their church, as well as Virginia. Why don't we say those states are the model? Roger Sherman, about whom you mentioned I'm writing a book,
right.
He was actually intimately involved in writing the First Amendment. He also wrote a religious toleration statute in Connecticut in 1784. Why don't we look at this as a model?
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting question. I think, unfortunately, the answer is law office history. In 1947, when justices decided that they wanted to interpret the First Amendment as requiring a wall of separation between church and state, they looked back to the founding era, and they cherry-picked documents that they thought would make their case. And they said, okay, where are these documents? It's not in Massachusetts, certainly. It's not in Connecticut. It's not Roger Sherman. It's not George Washington. But, aha, here's Thomas Jefferson. Well, he wasn't involved in writing the First Amendment or the Constitution, but still, we have this wonderful Virginia statute for religious liberty 5 years before the First Amendment was ratified. You have this letter to the Danbury Baptist a decade after it was ratified, but these are the key documents, almost to the exclusion of all other documents. It's really a horrible way of doing history, but it was a very useful way for these jurists to get their views into Supreme Court opinions.
And that's interesting, because then that solidifies everything in our academic knowledge of this as well. So just 1947 cherry-picked documents from the time, it's absolutely fascinating. Now, I know you've done a lot of work of looking at the Founding Fathers' view of religion and also their religious beliefs. You mentioned Roger Sherman here. You've also written on James Wilson as well. So give us the context of the Founding Fathers. I mean, there's lots, and it's not... You know, we immediately think of George Washington because there's pictures of him, and Jefferson because he's very famous and president, and James Madison and such. But what about the influence of these other folks? To what extent were these religious folks, were they deists? Does it even matter?
Well, that's a great question. Let me change it a little bit and ask, why are some founders famous and others aren't?
Yeah, that's very good.
It's a wonderful question. If you think about it, there's four or five founders that come to everyone's mind. All right, Thomas Jefferson, and George Washington, James Madison, John Adams. All of them became president,
mm-hmm.
right? All of them left an extensive paper trail All of them were consciously looking to be remembered. Thomas Jefferson invented a machine whereby when he wrote a letter, it would automatically make a copy of that letter, and he saved his letters assiduously.
Right.
The papers of Thomas Jefferson are going to be 70 volumes of the Adams family, over 100. So these are folks looking to solidify their place in history. They're clearly important, indisputably important, but were they necessarily representative of the American founders as a group, or were they even the most important founders? Let me mention Roger Sherman by way of contrast. But there are a lot of founders. Remember these documents that they produced, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, these are group documents.
Right.
They might have had a drafter, but they were amended, and ultimately they were voted upon. And so I think if original intent's going to matter at all, we have to look at the group and not just a particular individual. But someone like Roger Sherman from Connecticut, about which most people have never heard. They don't know
right.
him at all. Sherman is the only person that was involved in drafting and voting on four of America's most important organic documents. He was on the committee of five that drafted the Declaration of Independence. He also was on the committee that drafted the Articles of Confederation. He was a critical player, an absolutely critical player in the Constitutional Convention. In fact, recent scholarship has portrayed the Constitutional Convention as a battle between Sherman and his allies and James Madison and James Wilson and their allies. He was author of the Connecticut Compromise, for instance, something mm-hmm. we all know. Sherman then went on to serve in Congress, where he was a critical participant in the debates over the Bill of Rights. So unlike Jefferson, he was intimately involved. Just by way of contrasting Jefferson and Madison, for instance, Madison certainly was a big advocate of the Bill of Rights. But initially, when Congress addressed this as a unit, they appointed a committee of 11, one person from each state. Sherman was on that committee, so was Madison. The only draft of the Bill of Rights we have from that committee is in Roger Sherman's hand. So he was intimately involved. Congress and the House of Representatives then debated this Bill of Rights, and a lot of changes were made. A committee of three people was appointed then to put these changes into a final form. Sherman was on that committee. Madison wasn't. Madison supported a number of amendments, including one of which that he said was the very most important amendment, which was rejected. Every single amendment Madison proposed was changed in one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
The amendments then went over to the Senate. They were debated. They went back to the House. The House discussed them a bit. And just like today, a conference committee was put together. James Madison was on that conference committee, but so was Roger Sherman and one other person. And then the conference committee from the Senate was headed by Oliver Ellsworth, of whom Roger Sherman was the protege, or Ellsworth was a protege of Roger Sherman. Okay. And so I lay that out. That might seem like a lot of detail, but the point is Sherman was intimately involved in drafting the First Amendment. As you might imagine, being from Connecticut, being a good, solid reform guy, a Congregationalist, his views on church and state are significantly different than Madison's or Jefferson's. And yet the Supreme Court has virtually ignored Roger Sherman. I think they've cited him in their religion class opinions about three times, as opposed to Thomas Jefferson, whom they cited something like 120 times. And keep in mind, Jefferson wasn't even involved in writing or ratifying the First Amendment.
Absolutely fascinating. And your book that is forthcoming with Notre Dame is entitled The Old Puritan in a New Nation. Now, what do you mean by that term, old Puritan? Tell me more about Roger Sherman. And if he had his way in writing a church-state section in the Constitution, what would it have looked like?
Boy, that's a great question. To begin with, it's technically inaccurate to call someone in the late 18th century a Puritan.
Right.
Those came earlier, of course. But he was very, very reformed,
mm-hmm.
by which I mean a Calvinist, right? Jonathan Edwards Jr. was actually his pastor. Sherman owned every book, as far as I can tell, of Jonathan Edwards Sr. He read theology. He wrote and published a sermon. He debated theology with Samuel Hopkins. So here's a very, very pious Calvinist. Who certainly sees an important role for the state to play in supporting religion. Now, one thing that is critical is he believed in a very limited national government. So he thought a Bill of Rights wasn't even necessary because Congress simply wouldn't have power over religion. Congress has no enumerated power to create an established church, and so it's just simply redundant to have a First Amendment that say Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. As I mentioned before, Sherman authored a religious liberty statute in Connecticut. He didn't want the state to oppress people. He wanted the religious liberty to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he saw no problem whatsoever of a governor issuing a call for prayer and fasting, of the state supporting religious schools, of the state basically taxing people to support the church that they attend, much like Germany does today, right?
Right. They, you have a selection of different churches. The Netherlands do very similar type of situation. And it's interesting, when you talk about that, the issue of establishment then was very specific. One church supported. This was the Church of England model in Britain, right? And one could see that they didn't want that, but you know, today, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, it just seems to be stretched to everything if you happen to be, you know, wearing a crucifix and when you go to the courthouse. Oh, my gosh, you know, who knows? Right. Okay. So we have Sherman, you know, so his view, again, limited government, but sees a role for the government in promoting churches. National calls for prayer seem to be okay. You can use public money to support private schools and such like that. Let's slingshot this up into the future. We get a context for what that debate was at that time. You get the Sherman folks, Madison, Jefferson. We get this idea. And you mentioned earlier that Jefferson's letters and Madison's thoughts gets cherry-picked in 1947. And that was the Everson case?
Exactly right.
Before we talk about the Everson case, it's in reading some of your work, I'm basing a lot of what we're talking about here on an excellent paper that you wrote called, I might get this out of line, but Jeffersonian Walls and Madison Lines. And folks should get it and read this because it's a fascinating research project where you read, you know, something you said 300, 400 court cases and all the concurrent opinions. I mean, this is a monstrous research project to do all this. But what I found really interesting about this was that church-state cases, in the constitutional sense, the Establishment Clause sense, really don't appear until about the middle part of the 20th century. There's a period in time from, you know, the late 1700s, 1800, to about 1947, where, I mean, I think your paper said there's only a handful of cases, maybe four, five, six cases.
That's right.
Why? I mean, the fascinating case is, well, in that 150-year interim, why don't we have any establishment cases? And then why all of a sudden mid-20th century?
Sure, that's a great question. Well, of course, you know, Tony, the First Amendment begins, Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion. So the First Amendment, as it was written, is only a restriction on the national government. The state governments were free to do whatever they wanted. As we discussed earlier, Connecticut retained an established church until 1819, Massachusetts until 1832. But even after these established churches were done away with, you still had oftentimes religious limits, religious tests for office holding, state support for religious schools, certainly calls for prayer and fasting, election day sermons. Massachusetts had election day sermons well up into the late 19th century. And of course, within the 20th century, prayer in schools and this sort of thing. It wasn't until the Supreme Court, using the 14th Amendment, which was passed after the Civil War, in the 20th century, in a variety of individual opinions, the Supreme Court started applying the Bill of Rights to the states. So in 1925, for instance, the freedom of speech was applied to the states. In 1941, the free exercise of religion. And then in the Everson case in 1947, the Establishment Clause was applied to the state. The Establishment Clause being the first part of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion. So if you keep this in mind, and as well remember that prior to 1936, the federal government really did very few things.
Right.
It just simply was nowhere near as intrusive and large as it is today. And so basically the only time you had any sort of church-state case would be in the federal territories or in the District of Columbia. So you're exactly right. There's just a handful. After 1947, though, now you have all the states that you can look at. What would that be, 46, 48 states, and
right,
eventually 50 states. So the practices in all these 50 states, prayer in public schools, creation, manger scenes at fire stations and this sort of thing. Now you have all these cases from which to choose. And so we've seen a burgeoning number of church-state cases.
So this is an important lesson here, and this is one that I it's not only a lesson when we talk about religion here, but a lesson in general, that we see the expansion of these establishment court cases is really a function of the growth of federal power of government. That, you know, the 1800s wasn't a time when we got a lot of church-state conflict at the federal level because the federal government wasn't involved in that many things. And I think that's true in many other facets of our life. And you're right, 1930s, we see a major growth in government during the New Deal era. And then certainly during World War II and afterwards, the government has gotten exponentially larger. And so all these issues which were non-problematic before all of a sudden become federalized.
Right. Okay.
So what happens in the 1937 Everson case?
1947.
Oh, 47, excuse right. me, 1947.
The case involved a New Jersey statute that provided a subsidy to parents who sent their kids to religious schools to help transport them to these schools. And this was challenged I forget the exact groups, but groups similar to the American Civil Liberties Union that believed that the state shouldn't be involved in supporting religion in any way, shape, or form. A fellow named Philip Hamburger has actually written a book where he argues a lot of this was motivated by anti-Catholic animus, mm-hmm. because oftentimes the public schools at the time were basically Protestant schools. You had reading the King James Bible, you had prayer and this sort of thing. And the Roman Catholics said, well, we want our own schools. And right. we think it's fair, since we pay taxes, that the state would support us in various ways. And back, particularly on the East Coast, where you had a larger number of Catholics in the electorate, they oftentimes would get their way. And so there'd be various subsidies for these mm-hmm. schools. And so the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, which was eventually, the original name of that group?
What was the name?
Protestants and Others United for the Separation of Church and State.
Ah.
And so, and today, of course, they've changed their name to Americans United.
Right.
But that Protestants and Others gives you a flavor of what they were after. Oregon, I don't know if you knew this, in the 1920s, we passed an initiative banning private schools. Mm-hmm. No private schools in Oregon. And it just so happened that every single private school in Oregon but one was a Roman Catholic school. Right.
This happens to be, when we talk about this today, and there was a recent court case involving a university in Washington, they deal with the Blaine Amendments,
mm-hmm.
Named after, I believe, a Senator Blaine, who
That's right.
was unsuccessful in getting this passed at the federal level, but a number of states, I don't know the exact number of states, pick up on this and, based on church-state separation concerns, saying, well, we don't know if we can give public money for private schools. And back in that era, in the early 1900s, private school, as you recognize, meant Catholic school. So these had their roots. A lot of this stuff, as you mentioned, has its roots in an anti-Catholic bias.
That's exactly right. And one of the things you pick up in reading through all these opinions, like I do, is you get some real anti-Catholic rhetoric in the footnotes and whatnot that don't usually make it into the cases that are excerpted in law school textbooks and so forth. So in any case, the argument was, does the subsidies, this transportation subsidy, violate the First Amendment? And if you read through these opinions, Wiley Rutledge, in his majority opinion, said, we have to use history to determine what this amendment means. And he cites Jefferson and Madison. That was in his dissenting opinion. Justice Black, in his majority opinion, made the same argument. Now, Justice Black, who was a member of the KKK in his youth, he ends up concluding that the subsidies are okay because they go to the parents. But he laid out this requirement, this historical argument that the First Amendment requires, this wall of separation. Rutledge, in the dissent, is a 5-4 decision, thinks that even the subsidies of transportation should be prohibited. Well, shortly thereafter, in a series of cases, the court created a higher and higher wall of separation between church and state, most famously prohibiting teacher-led prayer in public schools,
mm-hmm.
Religious education within public schools, even if it's led by someone from outside, and this sort of thing.
So the critical importance here of the Everson case is that it sets a precedent of, let's go back and look at history. And not only let's go back and look at history, but that history is going to be the letter to the Danbury Baptists and Madison's memorial and remonstrance. And this might be a little bit out of your area of expertise. I mean, just reading, 400 cases on religion and politics is an enormous effort enough. But were there cases prior to this that didn't involve religion, that didn't involve the Establishment Clause or even the Free Exercise Clause, that justices went back and said, we need to understand, let's say, the Second Amendment or the Fifth Amendment in historical context, or was it unique to the First Amendment?
It's certainly not unique. Justices do that in other cases and in interpreting the powers of the presidency and so forth. They might go back and look at the concerns of the American founders. I do think it's particularly prominent in this area, and it's an interesting question of why. Why is this a case? And I believe the best answer to that is the justices knew these opinions would be very, very unpopular. To this day, a majority of Americans think there should be prayer in public schools, teacher-led prayer in public schools. And particularly back in the 60s, or the early 60s, a vast majority of Americans, I haven't seen the data, but I'd guess 60, 70, 80% of Americans thought it was just fine to have teacher-led prayer in public schools. And so if you're going to make that sort of decision, you certainly can't just say, well, these are our own private views.
Right.
You have to make some sort of argument. The First Amendment language certainly doesn't require it. So what you do is you go back, you say the founders, the American founders wanted this. And here's the evidence. Look at the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty. Look at the letter to the Danbury Baptists. Look at James Madison's detached memorandum, a private document he wrote after he left the presidency, where he regrets having issued calls for prayer and fasting, where he regrets even, he suggests maybe we shouldn't have congressional chaplains, even though he issued such calls and voted for such chaplains when he had the chance to do so.
That's absolutely fascinating. It's I can see where a justice making an unpopular decision. I mean, supposedly Supreme Court justices are isolated from public opinion, but you know, in reality, you worry about your own legacy and the pressure, and who knows, there could be marches outside the Supreme Court in some of these cases. So you certainly are sensitive to the political context that you're in. And so it only makes sense that they would go back and, you know, let's talk to the founders and see what they meant about that, fish around to see what their thinking was, not only within the Constitution, but outside of that Constitution. And it seems natural with that they would also pick very popular characters. You know, Jefferson, as you mentioned, you know, why is Jefferson important? Well, he got to be the president. Roger Sherman didn't become the president. And so more people know Jefferson, and that's an easy appeal. But I would also imagine that, you've used the term cherry picking here, that the case that Black wanted to make was specifically aimed, you know, he could pick these things specifically from certain documents. And same thing with Hamburger and such. So.
Sure. And I remind you, Tony, these documents are public documents put together by a group. And when you're putting together that sort of group, even if Jefferson and Madison wanted the strict separation of church and state, and I'm not even sure they wanted what the ACLU would want as to think the First Amendment requires, still you had all these other folks that voted on the amendment, right? On Vining and Ames and Sherman and Ellsworth and whatnot. And when you look collectively, there's just no evidence that these folks wanted anything like this. And I have a good story to tie back to the calls for prayer.
Let's do that.
I believe it was 2 days after the House approved its final version of the First Amendment, Elias Boudinot in the House of Representatives, who later went on to be president of the American Bible Society, he said, we should ask the president to issue a call for Thanksgiving. And Adonais Burke from South Carolina said, oh, no, we can't do that. That's too European. That's not good. Roger Sherman then stands up and says, no, calls for prayer and fasting are wonderful things. And remember, this is 2 days after the House approves the language of the First Amendment.
And recognizing, too, that Sherman was an advocate for this, for non-establishment. I don't want to use the term separation of church and state again because it's a loaded term, but for the context of the time.
You're exactly right. And so the House then votes on this, votes overwhelmingly to ask Washington to issue this call. The Senate concurs, and George Washington issues this wonderful call for prayer and fasting, which is republished all over the place, including in our book, The Sacred Rights of Conscience. And so what I would suggest there is when we look at the collective, James Madison maybe privately didn't like this, but Congress certainly approved it. So it's a real stretch to say that the First Amendment should be interpreted in such a way as to prohibit the president from issuing a call for prayer and fasting, as a recent federal district court judge did.
Yeah, that, I mean, let's hold off on that for a few minutes. I want to still pick up where we're left off here, 1947, the Everson decision. And I want to go back to the article that you wrote, the Jeffersonian Walls and Madisonian Lines. You did if folks get a chance to pick up this article, they should, because the research in there is quite incredible, the amount of effort that went into it. But you made some really interesting findings, because 1947, Everson is written, and it relies greatly upon Jefferson and Madison. Now, what happens with the citations of the Founding Fathers following that? Is it, do justices later on say, oh, wait, you know, Jefferson and Madison weren't the only ones. In fact, Jefferson was in France. What about the Sherman guy? And what about Wilson? And did they go back and look at these folks as well? Or did this become Jefferson and Madison territory?
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, just to make sure our listeners are all on the same page, there is a big debate about how you interpret the First Amendment, how you interpret other provisions of the Constitution. Originalists say we should go back and look at the language and look at the original meaning or the original understanding. Sometimes judicial liberals would say, well, we should, you know, take into account changing times and so forth and, right. and changing mores. It is interesting on this issue. Judicial liberals, and I could define that more specifically, but the sort of people we usually would think of as liberals, a Brennan, a Douglas, and others, are as originalists, they're actually more originalists than those that we usually think of as conservatives, as Scalia or Thomas, for instance. Mm-hmm. So everyone's using history. This isn't a conservative thing. Actually, the advocates of the strict separation of church and state are slightly more likely to make these historical appeals. The key difference is they focus like laser beams on Jefferson, Madison. The Memorial and Remonstrance has actually been attached to two different opinions. It's been cited routinely by these folks. What you did see in the 1980s is folks like former Chief Justice Rehnquist and then later Scalia and Thomas have gone back and they've said, wait a minute, Jefferson and Madison are not the whole story. They're an important part of the story. They shouldn't be ignored, but we have to look more broadly. We have to look at Washington and Adams and Sherman and the whole host of characters. And when we do this, we find, lo and behold, that the Establishment Clause basically means what it says, that Congress shall not make an established religion, similar to the Church of England. Mm-hmm. But there's absolutely nothing within this that would keep Congress from asking the president to issue a call for prayer and fasting, for providing funds to religious organizations, particularly in a non-discriminatory way.
A voucher system in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely.
Private schools.
Sure. Clearly, these things are not violations of the First Amendment as it was originally understood or meant to be. Now, they might not be good policies. We can argue about them. But if you want to make an originalist argument about what the First Amendment permits and doesn't permit, clearly these things would be permitted.
And this is what I pulled out of your paper, and this is an absolutely fascinating point, in that when you do make the original intent or an appeal to original intent, it sounds fairly clear-cut when you're talking about it in media discourse. So I'll just go back and we'll see what Jefferson thought. But you have to realize that it wasn't just Jefferson. It was everybody else. And so when you go back to original intent, you have to ask, original intent of who? And include in a number of other people. I mean, the other point that you made too, which I found fascinating, was that once the Everson decision picked up Jefferson and Madison and put them front and center, the justices, who are busy individuals and have a lot of homework to do, go back to the Everson decision and say, oh, Jefferson and Madison. And they probably get the image that those were the two go-to guys for this. So it seems to be a historical lock-in. You pick Jefferson and Madison first, and you're talking for the next 40, 50 years, you got Jefferson, Madison. So
yeah, no, that's exactly right. And justices certainly are very busy. But the historical story of Everson is just so patently false. Mm-hmm. It's just dishonest to continue to act as if this was the... this is an accurate history.
So, and you give a hint of that. You say in the 1980s, there's an opening up by Rehnquist and others saying, whoa, there's more to the story here. Do you start to see that in the data that more justices are looking at a wider swath of the ideas of the founders when they go back to this? Is that occurring now more frequently in the, say, the past 2-3 decades?
Well, you know, as you've alluded to, oftentimes the court can be profoundly political. And what you see is, perhaps no surprise, those justices appointed by Republicans, Scalia, Thomas, Rehnquist, and O'Connor, to a certain extent, Kennedy, are far more likely to see less of a wall of separation, right, between church and state, and are far more likely to make a broad range of appeals. You still have some justices that focus like laser beams on Jefferson and Madison, but some justices like Stevens, who's stepping down, of course,
right.
Pretty much has come up with a pretty interesting argument. What he's more or less conceded the historical case, and he said, well, look, if we were to follow the founders, then it would be perfectly fine for the president to encourage Christian prayer. And we obviously don't want that nowadays, so we can no longer follow the founders' views. And so he's become basically a good non-interpretivist, someone who says, you know, the founders, he recognizes that the founders didn't want a high wall of separation, but then he argues times have changed. In the late 18th century America, Americans of European descent were overwhelmingly Christian. About 99.9% were Christian. Almost 97% were Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, well, you know, this is just a very different environment. We now have Buddhists and Muslims and a lot more Jews and so forth. And so we can't have that anymore. So at least he's being honest, I think. He's being intellectually honest to mm-hmm. give up his originalist argument.
That's interesting to say. So let's go ahead and then talk about some of the more recent court cases that are out here. We said we'd come wrap around back here to the National Day of Prayer. And again, that is held on the first Thursday of May, traditionally, and the president always gives a call for the National Day of Prayer. Well, earlier this year, in 2010, it was declared unconstitutional, not by the Supreme Court, but by a federal judge in Wisconsin, if I'm correct.
Right.
And tell us a little bit more about that case and your reading of this, and where does this all stand in this debate?
Sure. Well, this modern National Day of Prayer more or less began in 1952, where Congress got involved in passing a statute that there should be a National Day of Prayer.
Right.
And in the early 80s, Congress amended the statute to basically require the president to issue a proclamation designating the first Thursday of May, as you said, as a National Day of Prayer. And so it's that statute specifically which she declared unconstitutional. Sometimes you hear on the radio, the National Day of Prayer has been declared unconstitutional. And that's actually not the case. Just the specific statute requiring the president to issue a proclamation. Presumably, the president could still issue a proclamation on his own in any case.
On his own accord, right, okay.
Right, and Barack Obama has done that. And mm-hmm. you can go find that easily enough on the internet. The argument there was that Justice O'Connor spun out this test called the endorsement test. She was okay with certain forms of government support of religion as long as it didn't seem to endorse one faith over the other. And so this district court judge said this is an endorsement. By endorsing prayer, it more or less favors it, saying religion is a good thing, even though these endorsements nowadays are very broad. They're not Christian at all, right?
Right.
Go to your places of faith and pray or meditate or do whatever else you do.
And I guess this is how it expanded from, you know, 1802 when that wall of separation debate was there, and, you know, in the 1780s, Memorial of Remonstrance and such. There they were talking very specifically about one church. You could put your finger on that church and say, you know, the Anglican church here in Virginia as being that church. But nowadays, if you just say, well, we want to endorse religion, that's a very kind of broad term. But it seems, and maybe this is Stephen's argument, that has become so broad that, you know, endorsing religion in a very amorphous sense means it leaves out the atheists, leaves out the agnostic, leaves out maybe religions that don't pray. That,
right,
you know,
right,
oh,
exactly,
we
right.
don't feel included in this National Day of Prayer. So that definition is certainly stretched like a balloon over periods of time.
Sure, that's right. One of the interesting things about this district court opinion is, although it didn't rely on Jefferson and Madison, it did suggest that there was a lot of controversy about this in the founding era.
Right.
And that's just patently false.
Yep.
Again, with the exception of Jefferson not issuing national calls for prayer as president, everyone did it. Washington, Adams, James Madison. I mean, it's just very common. Congress, the Continental Confederation Congress, the Congress, these guys hired chaplains, routinely issued calls for prayer. There was just precious little controversy. Jefferson, again, is somewhat of an outlier here, but that might have been for Tenth Amendment reasons as much as First Amendment, as suggested by his issuing of such calls as governor of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And we had another podcast with Eric Stanley of the Alliance Defense Fund, and we started talking a little bit more about this. that podcast dealt a little bit more with the free exercise clause and free speech rights of clergy, not so much the establishment clause. But nonetheless, one of the arguments that Eric Stanley made, and I'm interested in your comment on this, is that since we've gotten away from that, you know, 200 plus years ago of what we meant by establishment, we're just moving down a slippery slope of silliness in terms of, you know, what can't be done. Another recent court case dealing with establishment issues that made its way through the district court, but I believe the Supreme Court turned it down, was dealing with the Boy Scouts in San Diego, that the Boy Scouts had had a 50-year lease in, I think it was Balboa Park, and they wanted to re-up that lease, and they were sued by an atheist organization or a separation of church organization. I can't remember the exact name. You know, the decision was that since the Boy Scouts in their creed or their motto show some reverence to God, that if they are allowed to use public land, that's a government endorsement of religion. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I've not read that case. I've read a little bit about it. But you're exactly right. I believe the judge declared the Boy Scouts to be a religious organization. And of course, if you know anything about the Boy Scouts, yes, troops often meet in churches, but that wasn't the issue here. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think maybe in the Boy Scout motto, there's a couple words about honoring God,
right.
Although I'm not even sure of that. But of course, there's that in the Pledge of Allegiance, which hardly makes every organization that might say the Pledge of Allegiance, the Kiwanis, Rotarians, and whatnot, religious
right.
organizations. And of course, the vast majority of what the Boy Scouts do is not particularly religious, right? It's fire and campfires and merit badges and this sort of thing.
Exactly.
And to think that the authors and ratifiers of the First Amendment would have thought the First Amendment would prohibit these sorts of individuals from meeting on state land or federal land is utterly ridiculous. Again, I remind you, the day after Jefferson wrote this letter to the Danbury Baptist, he went to church services in the U.S. House of Representatives. As Washington got bigger, as it did in the early 19th century, there was a need for more than one church. Jefferson opened up some of the other buildings, the War yeah. Department, for instance, for religious services. He even sent the Marine Band to play sacred music in one of these services. And Jefferson, again, remember, he's the ideal of the strict separation of church and state, and he apparently had no problems with these sorts of things. So yeah, the founders, I think, would look at this and say, even in our pluralistic environment, this is just nuttiness.
It does seem that way. I mean, the court cases are coming up fast and furious. There was another court case, I believe, involved a girl from Washington State who wanted to play Ave Maria on her violin for a public school, and that became a big issue because obviously if she as an individual chooses this piece of music, this could be a government endorsement of religion. It's somewhat surprising. I don't know how many people would automatically convert to Christianity because they feel the government is endorsing this girl playing Ave Maria. So that it seems in many ways, like Eric Stanley says, just we're moving down the slippery slope of silliness. And I'm wondering to what extent there might be any pushback in the courts. Do you see any of this changing? Are we at this point where now that, you know, courts are just going to dramatically push religion out of the public sphere, or are we at a point of saying, you know, no, I think we've gone a little bit too far on this and, you know, give religion its proper space in the public arena?
I think right now we have five justices on the U.S. Supreme Court that basically interpret the First Amendment as requiring neutrality, which is probably not exactly what the founders wanted or thought it required. But actually, I think it's a very good jurisprudential principle. And what that is to say, look, it's perfectly fine for the government to be involved in certain ways in promoting religion and funding religious schools, funding social service agencies. What it can't do is discriminate. It can't say we're only going to fund Catholics and not fund Protestants, or we're only going to fund Christians and not Buddhists. As long as these benefits are made available to a wide variety of groups, religious and non-religious, it's perfectly fine. It has to be neutral. That's where five justices are. A couple of the other justices are sometimes good with that. And then you have a couple of strict separationists. Stevens was one, Ginsburg is another, that would say no funding of anything religious whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it's those sorts of folks in the Supreme Court, those sorts of folks in the lower courts, the judge that made this decision in the Boy Scouts case, or some of these displays of crosses on public land that have been there since the 1930s, that are leading to the silliness. And if you think about the silliness, right, what are we going to do? Have to rename Los Angeles and Philadelphia and San Francisco?
I mean, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
It becomes ridiculous, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then changing all of our coins. I mean, obviously you can see court cases like that coming up. Let me ask you another question to in realm of this. We're talking about the neutrality issue and whether we're at a state of neutrality or whether the government and the court system is being specifically aggressive toward religious organizations. Stephen Monsma and Chris Soper in their book Challenge of Pluralism made a very interesting case that governments that try to push out religions aren't really being neutral. They're actually favoring secularism as a religious ideal or atheism as a religious ideal relative to that. So the neutrality we're thinking of might not actually be all that neutral. What are your thoughts on that?
I think they're exactly right, and that's a wonderful book, and I commend it to the readers. I had Chris Soper out to give a talk one time. What he did is really pretty clever. He said, look, let's consider a variety of different schools, Catholic schools, Protestant schools, Jewish schools, secular schools. If the state were to say you can go to any of these schools, but we're only going to fund Catholic schools, would that be neutral? And, of course, the students immediately say, no, that wouldn't be neutral. And they say, okay, what if the state said that we're going to only fund the secular schools and none of the others? Would that be neutral? And you could just see the pause.
Yeah.
And students recognize, wow, that kind of sounds like what we do in America. We fund these things called public schools. And I'm a product of public schools. I'm not against them. Mm-hmm. But basically, we're funding these schools that we say, you can maybe teach a little bit about religion, but otherwise we want to exclude religion, and we certainly want to exclude teachers from any sort of religious exercise. From Monsman Soper's position, this is favoring secularism. In other words, there is no such thing as neutrality. Now, secular schools might be perfectly fine, but of course, Monsman Soper really like what the Dutch do, what they do in Holland, where the state basically says, we're going to fund all sorts of schools where there's a critical mass, as long as the schools do the basic things schools are supposed to do, reading, writing, arithmetic, and as long as they're not extremist hate filled schools of Nazis or something like that. If you have a Jewish school, a Baptist school, a Protestant school, a Catholic school, we'll fund them all. And it's interesting. People, I think, fear that this would lead to a Balkanization. But you think of Holland. It's one of the most tolerant countries in the world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And their point is that really this only becomes a problem when the state starts trying to favor one religion over all the others. But if it treats them all neutrally, that oftentimes actually ameliorates conflict.
And it's interesting. That might be one of the reasons why we see such tension in church-state conflicts today is that despite of the aura of neutrality that it's given, it's really pro-secular. And obviously this can aggravate a number of religious people within society who feel the need to push back to fight for their own rights. And so, it's a very interesting thing to think about. I've read Monsma and Soper's book and assigned it in class. We'll put a link to it on the website. It's a fascinating read. And, I've always been one to think about, and we'll kind of conclude with this, and I'll get your thoughts on this, is that I like the idea of this Holland neutrality where the government basically dishes out resources to all. But on the other hand, there's another part of me, and this is through my own research on pluralism, is that religion is strengthened best when it has to do it on its own. And this goes, I guess, with the National Day of Prayer, too, is that I can see how people are aggravated when, a district judge says, no, the statute that requires the president to declare a National Day of Prayer is unconstitutional. But on the other hand, I said, well, do we really need a government authority to declare a National Day of Prayer? Why can't we as Christians do this on our own? Why can't... I want the government to do a few things like defend me from outside invaders and protect me internally. Citizens, they can pray on their own. So what are your thoughts on this to conclude? How much should the government be involved with religion, and how much should religious individuals and clergy be asking from the government?
Yeah, I think that is a great question. I think you always have to be afraid of the golden rule, right? He who has the gold makes the rules. If the government's doling out resources, it might start having strings attached to those resources. On the other hand, to return to the realm of education, the Supreme Court has basically blithely said, well, you can send your kids to private schools if you want to, private religious schools if you want to. But of course, most Americans don't have the resources to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're President Barack Obama, you have the resources to send your children to a Quaker school. As he does. They said, well, Friends Academy, just like the Clintons did. On the other hand, if you're the poor single mom in D.C., you simply don't have those sorts of resources. So you're stuck sending your child to a school that perhaps is not reflecting a worldview and even teaching things against it. You look at the model of Holland, and they seem to be able to have this sort of neutrality that works out fairly well there. We've been doing this in higher education for years. I teach at a Quaker school, at an evangelical school. The students come here receiving federal aid, probably all of them in one form or the other, if you count student loans. And the state really doesn't say anything about what I do in the classroom. And it's left us alone, and we have a chapel requirement and this sort of thing.
That's a really fascinating point. The school voucher debate that occurs at the K through 12 level has always been fascinating. And people have thought, well, to what extent will the school voucher movement be successful in the case of Milwaukee or Florida or such and such? And I've always thought about this, and you just raised this up, is that we actually have a great example of a nationwide school voucher system in place here in the United States. It's called the American Higher Education System, that somebody can take their Pell Grant or their GI Bill and come to George Fox, go to Wheaton, as well as take it to the University of Washington or University of Oregon. It seems to work pretty well.
I think that's exactly right.
Well, great. Mark, it was great having you on the show today. And folks, just remember, if you want to make any comments to this or pick up a few of the links that we mentioned here during the program, please check us out at www.researchonreligion.org. And we will talk with you next week.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.